Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here with an author chat with Jay Chang, the author of our August book club pick, The Wings vs. the World, to talk about her latest novel, What a Time to Be Alive. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon supporter, you can access to our members-only Discord server, where you can chat with us and fellow book club members about our book club picks and other topics in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a book club pick once per quarter.
Yeah, so we had a great chat with Jade about social media, parasocial relationships, self-help and wellness culture, what it means to be a stan, and also cults. So
yeah,
we talked about a lot of things, and I hope you guys enjoyed this talk. And we are here with author Jay Chang, who has worked as an arts and culture journalist and editor for the BBC, Metropolis, Glamour, and LA Times Magazine. Her 2016 debut novel, The Wings vs. the World, won the VCU Cabell First Novelist Award and was a previous Books and Boba book club pick. Welcome to the show, Jade.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So we usually start our conversations with a little icebreaker to just ease into the conversation. So in your latest book, the moon is pretty prominent. There's a lot of cool facts in there. So I'm just curious, what was one cool fact you learned about the moon or you were surprised to learn while you were writing this book?
While I was researching this, I love to research things, and I got so deep into moon facts that I could not stop telling friends new moon facts. But I'm also very forgetful. So the one that has kind of lodged into my mind is the fact that the moon, and this is in the book, but the moon is moving away from us. So every single year, apparently, the moon is moving something like 1.2 centimeters away from us, which I think is a lot if you really think about it. I mean, I know it's tiny, and of course you're talking about two giant celestial bodies, but I don't know, keep moving something 1.26 centimeters away from you, and in 10 years, you can barely reach it.
I wonder how that affects tides and just climate change in general.
Yeah.
But that is for a scientist to answer,
exactly.
And we are not scientists.
Yeah, those are the types of existential questions that I try not to think about in my day-to-day.
Speaking of the moon, I just want to like shout out to your book designer, because I noticed that like the page breaks in your book are like phases of the moon. And I was like, oh, very subtle, very, very clever.
I'm so glad that you noticed that. I insisted perhaps a little too forcefully on it. And it was really so satisfying that we were able to do it. And I kind of ended up, they are exact, you know, so the book takes place during an entire year and it's not explicitly stated, but you can kind of figure out that it's 2019. And the faces correspond to exactly what the moon faces were on that day in the place that she is.
That's incredibly detailed, and also like props to you for going the distance for that, because it sounds like a lot of extra work, but I mean, it was a nice Easter
egg. But it was worth it. Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad. Also, I think you are the first person who has just noted it on their own without it having been like pointed out. So good job. You found the Easter egg. Thank you.
Yay.
Rira is very into book design.
I am.
Totally. I also feel like, you know, when you're coming out with a hardcover book, they're expensive. You're asking people to spend like $30 often. And I want to give you a little bit of, you know, like an object to actually enjoy in a physical way.
Yeah. All right. So we always love to start off our conversations by learning more about our authors. And like Rira mentioned, you started a career as a journalist before, you know, writing your novel. So just really curious, can you walk us through your, I guess, your journey to becoming a novelist?
Yeah. Well, I always, you know, like probably like many people in general, but also probably like most writers, I really grew up reading all the time. And I always wanted to write books, but I also knew that I was going to graduate college with a lot of debt and without a lot of money. So I knew I needed some kind of actual job. And I know it sounds crazy in retrospect, but being a journalist seemed a little bit practical. So I decided to do that. I started out with an internship at the LA Weekly, which is one of the, I mean, it does not, I know, like it no longer exists in its former state of alt Newsweekly glory. But yeah, but it was a great place to learn about fact-checking and research and, you know, what it takes to put together a publication. So I did that for a while. I had a brief sojourn teaching English in Japan for a little while. I also then began freelancing. I wrote a lot of arts journalism. I wrote a lot about, I worked for a magazine called Metropolis that is an architecture and design magazine. I wrote a lot about how people live in cities. I wrote a lot of like design process stories, that kind of thing. And it was really enjoyable. I really liked it. But the whole time I did feel like I want to write a book, you know? And I also felt like I couldn't while still trying to be a somewhat serious journalist. I just don't have like that much writing in my body every day, you know, to kind of do it for work and do it as this dreamy extracurricular. So I ended up taking a job that I kind of thought like, okay, this is going to be easy and a little bit frivolous in a nice way, which was a job at Angelino magazine, which is, I don't know, the easiest way to describe it really is that it is direct mailed to all the wealthiest zip codes in each city. So it really is, you know, tons of luxury ads. And it was like a good magazine in that everyone who worked there like really worked hard to make it kind of the best thing that it could be. But it also, I didn't feel like, oh no, what I do here as an editor is hugely, you know, impactful and difficult. So I took that as a, hey, this will be a little easier kind of a job. But then I was there in 2008 during the financial collapse, and I got a real front row seat to rich people freaking out. And that was very fascinating. And it actually was a lot of what led to me writing The Wangs versus the World.
Yeah. I'm curious about that process too, mm-hmm. because The Wings versus the World is pretty much as old as this podcast. It came out in fall of 2016. We launched in fall of 2016.
Happy anniversary to us both.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know, most notably, it came out a good 2 years before, like, the modern, like, Asian American narrative craze, right? Crazy Rich Asians, the film mm-hmm. coming out. And, you know, Asian American stories becoming, for lack of a better word, marketable, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I guess, can you walk us through a little? I'm really curious how you got The Wings versus the World through publishing during that time when I'm sure mm-hmm. it was a lot harder to sell that story, right?
100%. Yeah, it definitely was. You know, until that time, I do feel like the majority of the books by Asian Americans that were kind of in the marketplace were, you know, books about hardship and toil and suffering and people who all they want to do is fit into white America, you know, and that is not my experience. And that is not the experience of, I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. That is just miles away from the experience of the hundreds and hundreds of Asian Americans that I, you know, met throughout my like junior high school years. But it definitely, you know, it was hard to get an agent for The Wangs versus the World. At the time I hadn't published any fiction before, and I did have, you know, I had some friends who worked in publishing who kind of connected me to agents that they recommended. And the general consensus was like, we like it. We're not
sure. But will it sell?
Yeah, it was like a real. And then one day I was feeling a real kind of like sense of despair. You know, like I wrote this entire book. Am I even going to be able to find someone to represent it? And then weirdly, you know, it's funny. Someone just reminded me of this moment yesterday. I had actually kind of forgotten about it, but I like laid down in my living room and then in kind of like a puff of despair. And then I like looked across the room and there was Eddie Huang's memoir, Fresh Off the Boat, was on my shelf. And I was like, huh, I wonder who his agent is. And so I looked at the acknowledgments and there was his agent's name, Mark Gerald. And then I contacted Mark and then everything happened really quickly. You know, he got my query letter, read it, asked me for the manuscript. I guess immediately got on a plane, read most of the manuscript. And then as he was kind of getting his luggage and getting off the plane, he called me and was like, I'm in. So, yeah, it was crazy. It was like months and months and months and then like hours.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what publication is, a publishing industry is. Everything like happens all at once or nothing mm-hmm. happens for a very yeah. long time.
So. Yeah, it's so true. Yeah. But yes, I definitely also at the time, I did feel like my real selling point was like, this is a different kind of immigrant novel. And I'm really glad, actually, to say that now that line wouldn't work because now there are so many more people who are first or second generation immigrants who are writing novels that are very much about themselves and their family stories that are different in all kinds of ways. I mean, it's really amazing. Like in the time that you guys have been a podcast and in the time since The Wangs was published, how many more kind of Asian American voices we have. It's very cool.
Yeah, I think it's definitely something we talked about in our discussion, which is like reading this mm-hmm. book in 2025 is like a whole different experience. Like we wonder what it would have been like to read it in 2016 when it first came out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, mm-hmm. these days, you know, we read a lot of books sometimes, like, oh, this is a book about Midwest Asian problems. And you know, here's a book about SGV or LA Asians, which, you know, I grew up in San Gabriel. So like, it's a whole different, you know, like, set of circumstances and life experiences, yeah, right?
Totally. Wait, you grew up in the San Gabriel Valley. Have you read Fiona and Jane?
I have not.
Oh, you really should. Yeah. It's by a very good friend of mine, Jean Chen Ho. It's linked short stories, but it's set in, it has real SGV roots.
I love it. That's one of my pet peeves. It's like when people use the SGV as like a setting, but they don't understand the SGV. And like, it just.
They make it like your Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Like, it's like an exotic place. And it's like, no, people like normal people actually live here.
Totally.
I do want to hear your thoughts on just like your book is very much a love letter and kind of a roast to LA and like how absurd it can be. What do you think are the most common misconceptions about like LA from other states and people who live outside the country?
So when I first went to college, I grew up in LA. I went to Cornell, which is in upstate New York. And most of the people who go there, a lot of them are from kind of the tri-state area, right? And the first month that I was there, just over and over, people would be like, "Oh, you're from LA? You're so chill." Like, I mean, I am kind of chill, I guess, but no, not like significantly more so than the chill people who are from, you know, New Jersey or whatever. So I do think that is one of the big things, like, you know, that kind of Southern California stereotype. I think it's kind of amazing how much sway that holds in the popular imagination and how much people from other places really do think that they're going to land in LA and that's what they're going to see over and over. I also think the idea that, you know, that people in LA are more shallow or that they are more given to falling for like a cult or a guru or something. I just think all of that is human nature and it is, you can find it in people anywhere.
I mean, there's a lot of East Coast cults, so it's not just LA.
Exactly. It's so true.
Yeah.
And by the way, also cults around the world, like all people want in every culture, there are people who want to find someone to follow. And there are people who are very willing to say, "Hey, follow me," you know?
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of following and speaking of cults, I guess, mm-hmm. You know, your latest book, What a Time to Be Alive, is out now. And it's kind of about someone who becomes inadvertently a self-help influencer, which mm-hmm. is kind of like a modern day version of a cult leader in a lot of ways. Can you give us a elevator pitch for your new book?
So What a Time to Be Alive is a year in the life of Lola Treasure Gold. It's the first thing that I've ever written in first person. And I wanted to write it in first person because I wanted to write about the kind of early rise of a self-help guru from the point of view of the guru. You know, I feel like so often you get that kind of story and it's like from someone who's a desperate follower or from someone who like feels like they've been wronged by the guru or that kind of a thing. And you almost never, I mean, I'm sure it exists, but I have not encountered a significant number of stories where it's told from the point of view of the guru. So in this book, Lola is 31, which is, you know, right around that age where you feel like you should have everything all figured out. And some people in your life do, but it is also very common not to.
Who are these some people? I would like to meet them.
I mean, there's always a couple people who've like always known exactly what they wanted and everything's fallen in place for them. And, you know, but then they turn 40 or 45 or whatever, and then things change. But so she's at that age. Life has not been going very easily for her up until the book opens, and they get significantly harder because one of her best friends, who she's been very close to since they met in college, died in a sort of ridiculous way, and the book opens at his funeral.
Yeah. So when your publisher approached us about your book, they mentioned that the first manuscript you ever worked on but never finished was about a woman who accidentally started a cult. Like, this was like 10 years before you wrote Wings versus the World.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering how much of that first story made its way into this novel.
You know, I feel like the kind of questions and interests that were at the core of that book, which definitely, you know, I grew up in a completely not religious family. And I think I also kind of lack the like fandom gene, you know, not that I'm not a fan of plenty of things and that I, there are plenty of things
it's
that
a
I
lifestyle,
like.
You know,
it really is. And I'm not part of that lifestyle, you know, like there's a lot of things I like enthusiastically, but there's nothing I want to like put a poster of it on my wall, you know, and I've just never had that feeling, but I've always been very interested in it. And I've always been really interested in how people believe so deeply in things. And so I think that was a big impetus for the book, was the desire to examine that. And then I think also this kind of idea that if you are suddenly given this really unexpected sphere of influence, what are you going to do with it? Like, are you going to expand it as much as possible? Are you going to run away from it? What are you going to do when kind of slightly immoral choices present themselves? You know, are you going to give in or not? I think I found all of that really interesting. And that was something that I had already been thinking about when I first started working on the book. And I guess I should say for your listeners that the book opens with this funeral, and through various things that happened that evening, Lola, the main character, kind of ends up holding forth on the kind of cult that she would start if she did start one. And then someone kind of gets a hold of that. Someone records that, someone else kind of gets a hold of that footage, and it's and then cuts it in such a way that it just feels like she is declaring all these things, and then that video just becomes, you know, unexpectedly very popular.
Yeah. How many viral videos did you watch to like craft like the most viral way to like get Lola famous in your book?
That's a good question. I definitely watched several. I think it's also, I really thought a lot about kind of what it is that makes people latch onto a thing. And I think there's something about like a video, anyone talking where it feels like they haven't really planned it, where it feels like these words are just spilling out of them and they're like talking from their truest heart. We want that. Like, we want to believe in that. We don't want to feel like, oh, I've been taken in by something manipulative, you know? So there's something about that spontaneity. And then I also kind of, you know, it's a very like attractive setting that she's in. It's kind of, it's a little sexy, a little dangerous, a little unexpected. And then also the way that her friend died was that he was trying to do a skateboarding trick and it was ridiculous. And there is also a video of that, and that is paired with her video. So of course we all, you know, have a hard time looking away from sensational deaths. Yeah.
I am curious as to like what made you want to explore the industry of self-help, specifically like wellness gurus on Instagram, because we've always had self-help as like a genre. Like, you had like Eat, Pray, Love. And I mean, that author came out with another book recently and she admitted like attempted murder, but that's a different topic.
Really? I gotta look into that book more.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like Eat, Pray, Love has existed and like Lean In has existed. So like, I'm curious as to like what made you want to explore self-help on Instagram, on social media, and how is it different?
I think because on these social media platforms, it was really interesting to examine kind of how certain people were very successful at it and how others weren't, you know, and what kind of mechanisms they used. And to me, I thought it would be very interesting to have a character go in there where you're kind of trying to decide, like, how sincere are they? How calculated are they? And they are kind of examining all these people who are doing a similar thing. And the character is trying to, you know, Lola's examining all these people who are doing a similar thing. And she's trying to understand, okay, how do they do it? You know, I'm really interested in process stories. When I was a journalist, I wrote a lot of stories about kind of like how someone designed a better workspace, for example, or how someone built a business. And in a way, this is a business story, you know? This is about how someone builds a business as a self-help guru. And I think there's something about the social media aspect that does make those kind of tools and steps and decisions a little more apparent, you know, so that you can kind of watch along and figure it out. And that was really interesting.
Do you think like parasocial relationships is like a factor when it comes to social media wellness as opposed to like reading a self-help book?
You know, honestly, I feel like actually I don't know when the term parasocial was coined, but I do feel like it has been used in a widespread way, probably for the last 5 years around abouts. But I think that that kind of relationship occurred much earlier, you know? I think that like the way that people thought about like actually Elizabeth Gilbert is probably the best example. The best kind of slightly pre-social media example. I think people really did start to feel extremely connected to everything that she did and wanted to know like how her relationships were turning out because that relationship was such a big part of Eat, Pray, Love. And if these other people were going on Eat, Pray, Love journeys and trying to model their lives after her and her relationship didn't work out, then oh no, what is their life? You know, like I do think the parasocial aspect is not just on social media. I think it's just kind of human. We want people to model how to live.
Yeah. Aspirational.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still like shook by when you mentioned that like your story is actually like a startup story. It reminded me of someone told me, like, you know, did you know Ghostbusters is actually about a startup? I'm like, you know what? It is. Uh-huh. It just stealth.
It's true.
Yeah. And I mean, your novel paints a, you know, in my opinion, my personal opinion, a kind of horrifying picture of how social media commodifies like humanity,
mm-hmm.
like where even mm-hmm, moments mm-hmm. of like introspection and grief can be co-opted and monetized. And, you know, a big thing like you mentioned is like the search for authenticity and Lola's personal search for authenticity, you know, guides her throughout the book. But other people search for authenticity that kind of collides with hers and it really turns her into like the guru, right? You know, your novel approaches it very satirically, but I also want to ask like how your personal thoughts on, mm-hmm. you know, social media and influencer culture has changed through writing this novel, like through what you learned.
And I did want to like tack on this question. Like it took you a long time to write this book, right? So social media has changed so much since you started drafting in terms of just like, how like social media gurus have kind of like learned to grift. So you have like podcasters who are like who have like cult followings now. So I'm just curious as to like how that affected your writing about social media and influencer culture.
I think the way that social media has kind of changed and taken over our lives more and more. I mean, isn't it kind of nuts that only 10 years ago, I mean, it kind of there was like my, you know, like stuff existed, but it was not the same like juggernaut that it is now. I actually think the change of it only made me feel like this was more and more possible, you know, I think when I started writing this, there was not really a doubt in my mind, but more a sort of like, well, yes, I'm going to have to make people believe that someone could, based on a video, amass a following, right? And that was several years ago because I'm a very slow writer. And now that it came out in 2025, I don't need to prove it. Like, it's, everyone accepts that as a thing that, like, of course can happen. You know, you would think that after kind of examining it for so long, I would have gotten more and more cynical. I think I went in with a great deal of cynicism, and I actually have gotten, not that I like believe all of them are in it for the common good and you know, and that they're all that they all just want like the best for all mankind. I think lots of people are out there to just make as much money as they can. But I do think that we live in this world where everything is uncertain, where there is very little social safety net, where you don't know, like, whether the institutions that you kind of grew up thinking would help you, whether they're actually going to like turn around and kill you, literally, you know? And so I think that social media is this opportunity for a lot of people who often wouldn't have it otherwise, and who are sort of like willing to try, you know? And I think that there's like, I think there is a real bravery to continually putting yourself out there, you know? I'm sure that when you guys started this podcast, you had friends and family who were like, really, you're going to start a podcast, you know? I mean, people, that is how a lot of the world reacts when you are doing something that is a little bit unusual and is putting yourself out there in a particular way and putting your own like thoughts and feelings and opinions out there. So I think I've like seen that in more ways. And then I also have seen people kind of go through changes. Like, I think there are people who begin kind of saying like, I'm going to be a wellness person. I'm going to talk to people about like how to eat healthy and how to take walks and touch grass, you know? And then they kind of go through like an authenticity crisis almost, you know, where they're like, actually, guys, look at all this Coca-Cola I'm drinking. You know, I can't tell you, I can't say that I'm eating as healthy as I tell you all to. Like, I have seen a lot of that. And I find that entire cycle really fascinating. And I think that in the end, my feeling is that humans are so complex, and also that we all just kind of want to like connect and be seen and try to like do something that feels worthwhile. And I think, in fact, it's like not like I think everyone's good, but more that my empathy towards everyone has just like kind of continued to increase.
Yeah, I feel like that really comes through in your writing because, you know, both What a Time to Be Alive and The Wangs vs. the World, like, they feature some profoundly flawed protagonists that you kind of can't help but root for, especially as an Asian American, especially as a Chinese American, right? Like, definitely saw, like, not myself, but, like, people I know in your characters. Can you talk to us a little bit about what draws you to writing these types of characters and how you kind of thread that needle to keep the reader on their side, even with, as they make very questionable decisions?
You know, I really think that when you know what somebody wants, and if that want feels reasonable, you know, I mean, it could be like frivolous or crazy or whatever, but like reasonable to them, you know, and not like harmful to other people primarily. I think generally we want people to have it. Like you want people to get what they want, you know? So I think that is always kind of step one. And obviously I'm not saying anything like revolutionary there. You know, that's a real like screenwriting truism. Yeah, people talk about that all the time, but I do think it's very true. And then I just think that there are so many very delightful contradictions in people. And I notice them all the time. And I do want to see those in my characters, you know? And I don't think I'm not out there kind of trying to create someone that a reader will root for, but I am trying to create someone that I find interesting, a little bit confusing, you know, like they might surprise me. Like, what are they going to do? Not that I feel like they have control over their own lives. Obviously I'm doing everything, but you know, I'm interested in creating the kind of person who is a little bit surprising and who I personally find delightful, you know, even if I think like they're a real dick. So, yeah.
I mean, like Lola is a hot mess and totally. She's been a hot mess for a while. And like, this is like before her friend Alex passes away. And, you know, grief manifests in ways we never expect it to. And like, I feel like with her, like she obviously she never expected herself to go viral and become this wellness guru. Can you talk about like how Lola carries her own grief, like deals with that and also like use it for commodification? Because there's like how we deal with grief privately and how we express it in public.
I think like thinking about how people deal with grief was one of the most difficult and most fascinating parts of writing this book, because of course, like I have my own experience, and then I also have the experience of being close to friends and family, you know, who have been in terrible moments. And then there's also just like so much else of the world out there, you know? I knew I wanted her to feel like she, at a certain point, to feel like she had dealt with it. And then later for it to come kind of like roaring back, you know, and for it to really like flatten her again. And I think that probably came from just, you know, again, like personal experience. And then if we're being like callous about it, it also just seemed like an interesting emotional arc, you know? Yeah. But yes, the commodification of grief, I do think it's really interesting, because I think it's another one of those things that we kind of like to think is the result of social media. But think about like hired mourners, which existed in many cultures for generations and generations, you know? Think about like all the rules for exactly how long, you know, bereaved people should wear like particular colors and like lengths of skirts and lengths of sleeve. I mean, obviously every culture is different, but many, many cultures have like very exacting rules for all those kinds of things. And all of that is really the public commodification of grief. And all of that is a kind of way of expressing, of like creating a perceived value for the person who died and also for the person who was grieving. And so this is just, I think, a modern day version of a thing that we have always done.
Yeah, like I never thought of it like that before, how like the commodification of grief existed pre-social media, pre-media, because like you said, there are cultures with exacting rules on how to grieve. And if you don't fit that mold, if you don't follow the rules, then people are like, you're not grieving right. And it's like, yeah, there's been this policing of how we should grieve people. And like it is a thing that has existed for a very, very long time.
There's also people you hire to teach you how to culturally grieve, because I went through this when my grandparents passed away. We had
what do you mean?
Kind of like a funeral director, right? Like they walk you through like the what Buddhist chants to do, how long you have to like stand for and things like that. Like mm-hmm. if you're not familiar, there's like I guess like they're essentially cultural consultants for your grief.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. You know, the first time I've only seen it firsthand one time in my life was when my grandfather died, and he lived in Taiwan, and we were there, and we accompanied his corpse to the crematorium.
Yeah.
But when we got there, there was another family having like a funeral process. I think what must have happened is their funeral procession ended at the crematorium, right?
Yeah. Was it also at the municipal like crematorium that like everyone goes to?
It was up a hill.
Okay.
Up a very haunted hill where there's like fires burning at small mausoleums, like all up and down the hill. But at the head of that procession were two people dressed all in like white silk with long I don't know if all my details are exactly correct, but in my memory, they had kind of like longer sleeves, and they were like crying and hitting themselves with it might have just been their hands. In my memory, it's like sleeves, yeah. But I remember turning to my dad and being like, "What is this?" And he was like, "Those are hired mourners," mm-hmm. like that. They are there to like wail and make as much noise as possible.
That reminds me of like my grandfather's funeral. We're talking about grandparents' uh-huh. funerals, everyone. Lovely topic. Uh-huh. But I remember like as a kid, like I was so the only like funeral knowledge I had was like Western funeral knowledge. So I knew that you had to like dress in black, and there was like a coffin, and you know, there was like a wake and whatnot. But then when I went to Korea, everyone was dressed in white. It was like super traditional, and there was a right way to bow, and I couldn't do it correctly. And then my cousins laughed at me.
Oh,
and
no.
It's just like, I am sad that my grandfather died too, but I just don't know how any of this works. And you know, that isn't that the story of Asian Americans and Asian
diasporans
in general?
Yeah,
and also like you're saying that if I don't bow the way you're bowing, that I'm not as sad. It's rude. Yeah.
I think I got away with it because I was like a little kid, and they're like, oh, like, so cute, your clumsy bow. And it's like, oh, I did not grow up with the rules. I'm sorry. But speaking of like Asian diaspora, like, so Lola's immigrant origin story is like very unconventional. I mean, she was like 9 when her mother was deported back to China, and she was raised by Denise and her cult horror movie director father, which is like a very strange circumstance to be in. And I'm just like curious, like, what made you want to cultivate Lola in this very unusual family dynamic? And how does it impact how she sees herself as an Asian American?
I'm really interested in found families in general, you know, and I always think that that's just a really interesting like basis for relationships, right? I think I was really interested in kind of what is like what degree of gratitude does Lola need to feel for this family kind of raising her, essentially. And yeah, and I thought like that was a question that was interesting to look at. I think also I mean, I actually, like, I grew up with so many, like, essentially everyone I grew up with was a first or second generation immigrant, or like, they themselves had immigrated. And we had so many kind of, like, when I was in high school, obviously our relationship with Iran and Iraq was very tenuous. And I remember a friend's mom went back and could not return. And they were, you know, for a while kind of dependent on a, like, friend of the family to just come by and bring them food. I mean, think, like, situations like that were, of course, they were unusual, but they were not unheard of, you know? And there were a lot of situations where, like, family members were just kind of in and out of the world and our shared lives. And so I think that situation that Lola is in the book, yes, it is unusual, but I guess to me it did not seem completely, like, impossible, you know? I think also, so I grew up in the San Fernando Valley in Northridge, and we lived near CSUN. And one of the things that CSUN had was so many, so it wasn't just CSUN, it was actually so many young Chinese kids who essentially were, like, left in America to go to school. And a lot of times that began in, like, freshman year of high school, you know? So you're talking about people who are, like, 14 living by themselves in a little apartment. And yeah, so I think I just grew up around that, like, swirl of really what happens in a diaspora. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned earlier about, like, my pet peeve about people not getting the SGV and not getting the people here. And that's something I never felt with your books. Your books, you know, obviously because you grew up here as well, like, definitely feels like these are, you know, Southern California agents and characters. You know, I love that, you know, Lola's friend groups is just a, it's so diverse and so, but it's, it makes sense to me because, like, LA is a very diverse city. And so if you grow up here, you grow up with, you know, people who come from all over, and then you become friends and you all eat each other's foods, and it's no,
each other's
not,
food,
it's no,
and it, yes.
And it's no big deal, right? It's just what
exactly.
You do. Yeah.
Exactly. I'm so glad you noticed that, because I really did want that feeling of it, like, look, they're all aware of it and they like it, but it's also not a big deal. They don't celebrate it. They just are it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, Lola's, you know, immigrant identity issues isn't exactly like, who am I as an American, but it's like, where's my mom? Right?
yeah, exactly.
And even then, like, I think it could have, you could have easily turned this into, like, an adoptee looks for their birth family story. Like, we've read those stories for book club, and those stories are very important because, you know, like, those are people's lived in experiences. But at the same time, I was like, this is not, like, I was so happy that you didn't go that route. Like, it was just kind of like, my mom is missing. It would be nice if I found her, but I'm not going to put in, like, more extra effort than I've already had. And I just thought, I was like, okay, yeah, she's really going with her chosen family. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thought that was pretty refreshing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also, you know, as someone who is not an adoptee, I didn't want to write that story. Like, I feel like that is not my story to tell. And yet, like, this kind of world where weirdly I have kind of seen it a lot in reality, but not in, you know, not in, like, books or film or anything. Yeah, felt like something kind of really interesting to explore.
Yeah. Okay, I'm really curious to learn about your inspiration for the name of your protagonist, protagonist, Lola Treasure Gold. Like, you do go into great detail on the reasons why she's named Lola Treasure Gold, but and the significance of each, like, word of that name. But I want to hear about more about your process in deciding, like, this is what my character is going to be called.
So Lola is from Lolita and, you know, the Nabokov book. And I think I, like, early on in writing the book, I had a little more from that book in there, you know, a little more from Lolita in there. But I do, I think I love absurd situations, and I love like the ways that people choose their names in different cultures, you know? So in Lola's case, her mom came to America pregnant and then gave birth to her in America when she still wasn't really like that fluent in English. And so she has really unexpected like reasons for naming Lola what she does. And I wanted a name that felt kind of like really big, you know, a name that like a guru could have this name. What is this? You know? And yet that had actually like a certain amount of, and, you know, I'm not going into all of it here, but like a certain amount of like reasoning and cultural significance.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I will say it is like a large part of it is to amuse me, probably. Yeah.
It was definitely one of my favorite like parts. It's just reading this. Just so absurd, but I can definitely see it happening. I can definitely see the situation that led to her being named this very, like, what's the word, like, opulent? Like, very, mm-hmm. like, big name, mm-hmm. right?
Look, I have a friend whose father named himself Pegasus.
Oh.
What? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just all
I mean, I had a classmate named Aristotle. He was Chinese. So
exactly.
I do know a Chinese guy named Storm. Uh-huh. So I think,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, see? Exactly.
Yeah. I just like laughed when they were talking about middle names. They're like, oh yeah, everyone in America has a middle name. And I'm like, yeah, this is because of this preconception, my name got split in half when I immigrated to America. That's why like my first name is Ree and my middle name is Ra. And I'm like, that's not, I don't want to spend money and time fixing that legally, but that is what happened. And just blame it on like assimilation and my parents like not knowing any better. So I just like laughed when they were like, oh yeah, everyone has a middle name. So we're going to give her the middle name Treasure. And I was like, okay.
Wait, that is so interesting. Because I feel like when I was growing up, I remember being like, oh, so Korean names are separated. I see. But someone must have told like, so many Korean immigrants to do that, to like split the, yeah.
I mean, like, it's like a little bit complicated with like the hyphenation, because like, it's just like, where do you put that in your legal documentation? And yeah, it's just like very complicated. But it's also very complicated when you go back to Korea and you're filling out forms and they're like, what are your Chinese characters? And I'm like, I don't know. I can barely write in Korean. You want me to like write it, my Chinese name?
Too?
Absolutely, God. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I like, we are like going towards like the end of this interview, and I did want to ask like one last question. So the title of this book, What a Time to Be Alive, was this your original title?
Well, it's definitely, I did not come up with the phrase, right? It is something that people say on the internet, you know, it's definitely something that you see in the comment section of a lot of things, perhaps with that little shruggy emoticon, which I also is a symbol I really enjoy. Yeah, so I liked the idea of a title that felt, there's something about this phrase that feels both like a proclamation, you know, like it's kind of being really bold and putting a big stamp on things and saying, what a time to be alive. And then there's something about it that also feels like, oh, what a time to be alive. Like, gross.
Like, I don't want to
horrifying.
Be alive right now.
Yeah, exactly. And that like double meeting of it just felt so appropriate for kind of the like back and forth, the emotional back and forth that Lola goes through throughout the book. And then I think it just feels very correct in our current moment. You know, I think like, I don't know anyone who doesn't feel like they're constantly toggling between the two things. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And that's all we'll say about that.
It is a very appropriately titled book.
Oh, yeah. It is. For better or for worse, it is.
Well, Jade, congratulations on your new novel. It was just so much fun to read. Have to ask this because it's, you know, this is what we do. But are you working on anything else right now?
I'm not actively working on anything else right now. I really feel like, you know how when people, so weird, when people make a free throw, you know how if you don't follow through on that free throw, it's not going to go in the basket? It feels like I need to concentrate on kind of this book being out in the world. And I don't even mean kind of like the act of promotion, although of course, like it is a book, I have to sell it, you know, it, of course that is part of it, but I actually mean more just like me thinking about and understanding like how I want it to be in the world. You know, I feel like I have to, at least for a little while, like focus on that before I can really start 100% thinking about something new.
Yeah. Well, we're honored to be part of that free throw follow-up of your journey.
You.
And honestly, just looking forward to whatever comes next from
thank
your,
you.
Your pen. But thank you so much for joining us on Books and Books. This was so much fun. And yeah, we'll talk to you later.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was so nice to meet you guys.
And that was Jade Chang. Her newest novel, What a Time to Be Alive, as well as her debut novel, The Wings vs. the World, are both available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books and Boba online bookstore. So if you liked what you heard and want to check out her book, head on over to booksandboba.com, check out our bookshop link. Any purchase made on our online bookstore support not only us at Books and Boba, but also your local bookstores. So definitely appreciate everyone who has bought a book from us there so far. All right. Before we go, Rira, can you remind us what spooky book we are reading this month for book club?
So this month is our Patreon's pick, and we are reading Bat Eater and Other Names for Cora Zhang, a horror mystery of a Chinese-American crime scene cleaner, serial killers, and hungry ghosts. As you can tell, it has all of those things. It has hungry ghosts, trauma, serial killer, and and takes place during the pandemic, so it is a lot of spooky things wrapped into one.
If you are a Patreon supporter, you can read along with us on Discord. It is a pretty gruesome book, so definitely approach with caution if you're a little squeamish there. But looking forward to discussing this with all of you online, and also with you, Mira, at the end of the month. But with that, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba. Thank you once again to Jade Chang for joining us. We'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallusbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.